Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. If you were Rip Van Winkle, asleep for the last 20 years, and you woke up yesterday and turned on the news, you might have thought you had just dozed off for a few minutes. Everyone was celebrating Nelson Mandela, and Bill Bratton was being introduced as the new police commissioner in New York City. We will talk about the evolution of both men on today's program. One person very relevant to both who will be on later is former Mayor David Dinkins. He brought Bill Bratton to New York in 1990 as transit police commissioner, and he brought Nelson Mandela to New York in 1990, just months after Mandela's release from prison, to receive a ticker tape parade down the streets of New York. Mayor Dinkins coming on to talk about both those things later in the program. But first, we have a very special guest to start us off on this week that the Moreland Commission report was released in hopes of cleaning up corruption in New York. With me first today is Kathleen Rice, the Nassau County District Attorney and co-chair of Governor Cuomo's Moreland Commission on Public Corruption. Can it make a difference? Will the governor fight for its recommendations? D.A. Rice, thanks very much for doing this, and welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
You know, it used to be New Jersey we would laugh at as the corruption capital of at least the Northeast and maybe the United States. Then it seemed to become New York. NYPIRG counts 29 state office holders in the last 7 years who've been either convicted of crimes, officially censured, or accused of wrongdoing in some other way, including in top leadership positions, as you well know, for alleged personal financial gain or political gain. Malcolm Smith, Joe Bruno, Pedro Espada, Alan Hevesy. I could go on. How bad is New York's corruption problem compared to the nation as a whole?
I think it's really right up there. There's no question that some of the names that you have rattled off, there are many more to add to that list. We've seen a parade of legislators being taken out of the Capitol in handcuffs. And what it has done has really broken down the level of trust that every New Yorker deserves to have in their government. And that's what, it really is what spawned the Moreland Commission to begin with. The incessant arrests, it was just always one day after the other. You open up the newspaper. So, I'm proud of the work that we did. We've done it under a very tight timetable, and we're going to continue over the next year to do more.
And listeners, we've been talking about this all week. We've had three or four guests. Governor Cuomo called in the other day to talk about it, as many of you heard. So if you want to ask the co-chair of the commission, Kathleen Rice, the Nassau County DA, a question, you can do so now at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And it's those illegal corruption cases in the headlines that, as you say, got the commission going. But most of your recommendations seem to focus on legal corruption, all this influence peddling by people with money.
What I said from the very beginning was everyone knows what's illegal. We see the U.S. attorneys and other law enforcement agencies making the arrests. But what I predicted from the very beginning was that this commission was going to actually uncover and shine a light on all of the stuff that's legal that shouldn't be. And what we've shown is that there are just piles of money pouring into Albany. And the result of that is that the government has become a representative of the very few, not every single New Yorker. And so that is really one of the main issues that we addressed. And I think we gave chapter and verse of our investigations, what the results, preliminary results of our investigation have shown. And the behavior is really deplorable.
So you suggest things from public campaign financing to more disclosure of lawmakers' outside income to reducing the maximum amount of campaign donations, which is so high. In New York State. What's the number?
New York, well, for a statewide candidate, it's $60,000.
$60,000.
It's ridiculous. It's higher than any other state. And then you look at also the rules regarding LLCs and how they are considered in terms of contributions. And you look at the fact that you can make unlimited contributions to campaign housekeeping accounts. So the money just pours in. And the core of our recommendation, which is a public financing system, that at its core is the first step to reducing the flood of money into the system. What it does is it levels the playing field. It allows regular New Yorkers to participate. It encourages small donations. And it really is the first step of kind of getting that large amounts of money out of the political process.
So are you recommending a model for the state like the city of New York has with its 6-to-1 public financing match for campaign donations under $250? That creates a powerful incentive to rely on many small donors, because then you get 6 times what you get, from the public purse. And this is seen as a national model.
No question. We heard a lot of evidence at public hearings about how the New York City system works. We looked at other states like Connecticut. And look, no system is perfect, but the system we have now is untenable. And so we do make the recommendation that we model it after the New York City system with small donor matching funds. And, we really think that that's going to encourage participation, not just by regular New Yorkers, everyday New Yorkers, but it's going to open the door for other and better candidates to run because they are going to be able to do it by raising, smaller donations and not having to tap into the special interests and the moneyed interests as well.
But it's important to note how difficult this is to get through. Even on your commission, there were 7 dissenters on this particular proposition out of how many commissioners?
There were 25 of us.
So 7 out of 25 dissented. And as you know, the governor tried and failed to get public campaign financing through the Senate last year. Do you have any reason to believe that next year can be any different?
My hope is that next year will be different. My hope is that this report will stand as a blueprint for how we can change the system. And it's not just public financing, although, one of the complaints that the dissenters made about the public financing system is the taxpayers don't want their money to go to these campaigns for people that they might not like and might not support. And I hear that. I understand that argument. But what the taxpayers need to understand is that right now they're paying for it the way the system is right now, with all of the corruption that's going on, with abuse of member items, even though member items don't exist anymore in a post-2011 world.
Member items being
discretionary
spending.
Funds.
Just pools of money that these members can spend on whatever they choose.
Exactly.
In their districts.
Exactly. So we are paying for it already to the tune of a lot more money than the $3.20 a public financing system would cost. These are the averages that we,
per taxpayer per year.
Exactly. Every year, $3.20. So when you think, when you say, wow, this system is going to cost a lot, what it's going to do is make it's going to level the playing field. It's going to engage New Yorkers on a much more fundamental level, which I think is really, really important. It's a very good first step to restoring the trust that the public deserves to have in the system.
So listeners, public campaign financing for New York State, pro or con? And any other questions you want to ask Nassau County DA Kathleen Rice, co-chair of the Governor's Moreland Commission on Public Corruption, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. I mentioned, DA Rice, that the governor called into the show on Tuesday to talk about your report, and I want to replay one very short statement that he made that I've been thinking about since.
I want a legislative resolution. I don't want just a quick fix. I want the law changed so we have an even more transparent system that people trust and people have faith in it.
So he said he wants a legislative fix. Does that imply that there are things that he could do even if the legislature is gridlocked? Are there executive actions that you would argue after studying this that the governor can take on his own if necessary?
I think the governor has shown a desire to reform the way Albany works. He did away with the member item system, a really good first step. So there are some things I think that the governor can do, but what the public needs is for the legislature to act. And what was clear from the report, Brian, is that there are the commission didn't say that every single legislator is bad. There are a number of legislators who are good and honest, and they believe in transparency and reform. Now, there's another group of legislators who are totally invested in maintaining the status quo. And what our investigation is going to show in the upcoming months is where each legislator falls into which category they fall. I think it does have to be a legislative action, because I think it's important for everyone that we send to Albany and vote for and to represent us in Albany is part of this reform. You can't have just one branch reform the entire system. So I think it is mostly legislative.
Now, one criticism of your commission, however, is that you were appointed by the governor and you made no mention of corruption prevention for the governor's office, raising questions about the commission's independence and comprehensiveness. Here is one of the members, the Onondaga County Executive, Joan Mahoney, in an interview with YNN's Capital Tonight.
But I think we're making a mockery of this whole process if we try to pretend that a group of us that's been appointed by the Attorney General and the governor is investigating the Attorney General or the governor.
Mm.
If, you know, so I never subscribed to that notion to start with, and there has been no conversation inside the Moreland Commission to do anything other than address public corruption and these instances that are outlined in this report, which are all legislative.
Fair critique on your limitation?
I, with all due respect to my fellow commissioner, I don't think that she was right in her opinion, and that is her personal opinion. She doesn't speak for the commission. It was very clear from our executive order that our mission was to follow the money wherever it went without fear or favor, and that's what we did. The reality is that the instances of corruption, the most egregious instances of corruption that we've seen over these past years, have come out of the legislature. That's a fact. And so when you go to follow the money, it's not surprising that a lot of the instances that we point out in the report have to do with the legislature. So we were not given any restrictions in terms of where we could look or who we could look into. It was purely following the money, and that's what we did and what we're going to continue to do.
Let's take a call. Here is Steve in West Hampton. You're on WNYC. Hello, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
My point in this thing has always been in the public campaign financing has always been to attack it from the other side, which is the cost of financing, and that the airwaves are in the public domain and regulated by the public. And they are probably the largest single expense that a candidate has. And so I've always felt that if we just demanded that radio and TV media allot a certain amount of advertising time to qualifying candidates, that you could probably wipe out three quarters of the cost of a campaign.
Steve, that's a great point to make, and I should say that doesn't affect us because we're public radio and we do not take campaign advertising of any kind. But it is such a money generator for the commercial stations. And as he says, this is the bulk of the cost. This is why they need all that money that they're getting from all these big donors, or at least that's one of the main reasons, probably the main reason. Did you consider looking at the, I guess it's the supply side rather than the demand side?
Well, the reality of the situation in New York, more than any other state, is that elections cost a lot of money. Races cost a lot of money. That's why people go and reach out to the people with deep pockets, because it does cost a lot of money. But look, that's the business that people are in. They have a right to make money, and that's part of the process. But the other thing about the public financing system is that there are limitations on what you can spend. And so people have to be very careful about and selective about how they spend their campaign money. And whether that's choosing radio, TV, or boots on the ground, whatever it is. I hear what the caller is saying, but I think that there are ways of dealing with that, you know, within a public financing system.
Sam, and is it Governor New York? Sam, you there? No, Sam. Okay. Sharon in Rockland wants to follow up on the question about investigating the governor's office. Sharon, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I have a very bad connection.
We can hear you, though.
Okay. I just want to know if the Moreland Commission is going to open up the lobby records that the governor has, so we can see who's actually going to see the governor. Who the lobbyists that are coming into the governor's office. Will the Moreland Commission require that?
Thank you for your question, Sharon. Our investigation is ongoing. As you know, our report that we just put out on Monday was an interim report. We made our policy recommendations in it, and we also gave a really detailed description of some of the investigations that we're doing. We obviously left that all anonymous because it would be inappropriate to put names out there of investigations that are not yet complete. And what I can tell you, Sharon, is that we are doing a very, very deep investigation. And lobbying is one of those areas that the executive order allows the Moreland Commission to look into. And we actually mentioned some of those issues in the interim report, and we're going to continue to look into that as well.
One thing that caught our newsroom's eye was illustration number one in your report. It's a tantalizing case study, but we saw that it has the organization's names redacted, scrubbed out in black. So what can you tell us about that organization and why you included such titillating and potentially incriminating details about activities that look fishy without names?
The commission felt very strongly that the public has a right to know what we have done up to this point, not just from a policy perspective and the testimony that we've taken regarding what the best system for New York should be, but also the investigations that we're doing. You know, it's important for people to remember that the Attorney General has deputized every commissioner and given us subpoena power, which is not something that any commission has had before. And so we felt it was very important to inform the public about the kind of investigations that we were doing up to this point. But as anyone who has ever done investigations of this type know, that you have to preserve the integrity of those investigations. And our hope is that very shortly, as we conclude our investigations, we're going to be able to talk much more explicitly about them.
So if the investigation isn't done, why give a heads up to the involved legislators and agency? Do you, in effect, tip them off here in a way that would give them a head start on covering up?
I think that we left it anonymous enough that, look, the people who are involved and do wrongdoing know what they are doing. So there's they're tipped off already because they know what they've done. But it was very important to the commission that in the recommendations that we made for this report and this commission to be different, Brian, what we had was all of these investigations that we did. How are you going to get the legislature to act on making these changes? Well, it's to show the public very explicitly the incredibly egregious, deplorable behavior that we are uncovering. And that, together with the policy recommendations, we hope will lead to real reform.
Before you go, since we talked mostly about the recommendations to fight the legal corruption, how about the illegal corruption? What's the best way to fight that so we don't see more of our elected officials being, you know, walked out by DAs like yourself in handcuffs and finding out that they're making weasel deals that affect the public policy?
One of the issues that we have here in New York is that federal prosecutors have more tools to go after corruption, illegal cases of corruption, than local DAs do. And we're the ones with the institutional knowledge. We are New Yorkers here. We represent state and local government. So we made recommendations regarding beefing up the bribery statute and other recommendations that we can do from a statutory standpoint that will give local DAs the tools that we need so that we can make these cases locally and not have to rely on our federal partners.
How do you follow up on this report?
We're going to keep these investigations going. Our final report is due in January of 2015, and our hope is that we can uncover more instances of the corrosive effect of money on the political process, and hopefully that will lead to groundbreaking reform that we so desperately need here in New York.
Anything else you want to say that I didn't ask you about?
No, that's. I think you covered everything, Brian.
The DA for Nassau County and co-chair of the Moreland Commission on Public Corruption in New York State, Kathleen Rice. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Up next, the evolution of Bill Bratton with reporters who covered him in Boston, L.A., and New York. Stay with us.